On the morning of September 14th, 2007, 14-year-old Andrew Gosden hopped a train from Doncaster Station, riding nearly 2 hours into the heart of London. Surveillance cameras show the young man walking up from the track, through the station, and ultimately exiting onto the street. These are the last confirmed images of Andrew. The Gosden family discovered that Andrew was missing that evening when he wasn't in his room. Subsequent phone calls provided the troubling news that Andrew had never attended school that day, and by the time it was known that he'd gone to London, valuable time had been spent and days wasted. For many, the question of why Andrew went to London is almost as compelling as what became of him. For the last 12 years, the Gosden family and police have tried to find the answers, and with each new possibility, have been met only with dead ends and broken leads. Speculation is thick around Andrew's disappearance, with some believing the teenager took off on his own, and others wondering if perhaps he'd been coaxed into a situation from which he could not escape. What happened to Andrew Gosden? Did he choose to leave on his own with plans he never revealed? Was he drawn into London by someone he believed he could trust? Or was this a case of a teenager cutting school for a fun day off and sadly finding himself on the wrong side of foul play? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 82, The Vanishing of Andrew Gosden. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the mysterious disappearance of Andrew Gosden in 2007. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focusing on a different unsolved case each week. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at @TraceEvPod, on Instagram at @TraceEvidencePodcast, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. As a final note, Trace Evidence is a complete one-man operation, so if you'd like to help support the podcast, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can gain rewards such as stickers, pins, and other surprises. If Patreon isn't your thing, but you still want to pitch in, there is a PayPal donation button on the website. Today we examine the disappearance of Andrew Gosden, one of the cases I've received the most requests for. I wanted to give a quick shout out to Amber, a friend of the show who has been requesting this case basically since day one. This is Episode 82, The Vanishing of Andrew Gosden. Andrew Paul Gosden was born on July 10th, 1993, to parents Kevin and Glennis Gosden, both of whom worked as speech therapists. At the time of his birth, Andrew was the Gosden's second-born child, with him having an older sister, Charlotte, who was 2 years his senior. Andrew would grow up with his family in Balby, a suburb of Doncaster located in western South Yorkshire with a population of just over 15,000. Central Balby is located approximately 2.6 miles or 4.2 kilometers from Doncaster proper. Andrew's parents were both devout Christians, and while they were firm in their beliefs and devotion to their religion, they elected not to have either Andrew or his sister baptized, as while they would introduce them to their belief structure, they did not want to force their beliefs onto their children before they were old enough to make their own choices. Andrew's family described him as quiet, thoughtful, and gentle. He was somewhat introverted, but caring, and was very close with his parents and sister. One feature of Andrew's personality, which was apparent from a young age and continued to sharpen throughout his life, was his intelligence. When Andrew began attending school, it wasn't long before he was taken into the Young, Gifted, and Talented program instituted by the United Kingdom government in 2002. The program was described as focusing on enhancing the development of students who were defined by having one or more abilities develop to a level significantly ahead of their year group. This particular program was open only to those individuals who performed in the top 5% of students. Andrew's behavior was typically withdrawn, at least in terms of the social circles that ran in school. That isn't to say that he didn't have friends. There was certainly a small group with whom he palled around with while at school, but usually once he made his way home, he preferred the quiet of solitude. According to his family, despite his more closed-off personality, he was an open and caring young man. Even while appreciating his alone time, Andrew's family often spent evenings together, working on arts and crafts projects or playing games. He was close with his sister, and according to friends, there was no indication that Andrew was subjected to any kind of bullying or mistreatment that would lead him to be more withdrawn. It was a decision made by Andrew that was, as is often the case with highly intelligent youngsters, being more interested by his own company than hanging out with friends. Oftentimes, this kind of isolation and a tendency to spend time alone can be associated with depression, but Andrew's family and friends have all expressed that they'd never seen anything to indicate to them that the teenager may have been struggling with any psychological issues. This, of course, does not necessarily mean he was clear of the grip of depression, as some symptoms can be easy to miss, but for what it's worth, no one in his life considers that a possibility, or something that played a role in his disappearance. In a typical day for Andrew, he'd often return home from school, change out of his uniform, and spend countless hours alone reading, writing, and listening to music. His bookshelves were adorned with well-used copies of books such as Harry Potter and Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. At the time of his disappearance, though, Andrew had been intently reading through Beyond Good and Evil, Nietzsche's follow-up to Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Not exactly light reading, though in a rare interview conducted by The Telegraph, Glennis momentarily pondered whether the draw may have been Nietzsche's Übermensch, or Superman, a uniquely interesting concept for a boy growing up in a Christian family, as it deals much with the nihilistic view that God is dead, and it is in ourselves and future generations in which we must place our faith and carve out our own destiny. Andrew's taste in music leaned towards heavy metal, with posters tacked into his walls and t-shirts in his closet adorned by the logos for bands such as Cradle of Filth, Funeral for a Friend, and one of his favorites, Slipknot. Even his backpack, a canvas one-strap crossover shoulder style, was collaged with stickers, patches, and handwritten names of bands, songs, and albums. While Andrew had much to keep him company, it was his favorite activity of gaming that captured much of his attention. Whether it was on a console, PC, or handheld device, Andrew was a gamer and thoroughly enjoyed overcoming the obstacles and challenges set before him, though again, they were not always the most intense trials for someone of his intelligence. One thing I should note about gaming is that many articles discuss that Andrew was a PC gamer. This may have been the case, but it certainly wasn't something he was doing at home. The family didn't have a computer until 8 weeks before Andrew's disappearance, and even then, it was a laptop which Charlotte had received as a gift. A lot of speculation in regard to Andrew's disappearance revolves around the possibilities of him making connections online through gaming or social media. While this could be a possibility, it does seem highly unlikely given details of the investigation, which we'll get into later in the episode. There was little challenge for Andrew's brilliant mind when it came to academics either, and it has since been described that Andrew cruised through classes and assignments, finding little to truly require that he push the limits of his capabilities. Despite this seemingly advanced intelligence, school was, to some degree, unimportant to Andrew. In an interview with Vice, Andrew's father Kevin stated, quote, "To be honest, I think Andrew saw school as something you sort of had to do just in order to have choices open to you for adult life," end quote. While Andrew was smart all around, it was in mathematics where he truly excelled, with teachers going on to describe him as a math genius. At the time, it was believed that with this grasp of math and his general intelligence overall, he was going to blow through his GSCEs, the General Certificate of Secondary Education, and from there be accepted into a prestigious university, such as Cambridge. While Andrew may have displayed a genius level of intelligence, book smarts, and understanding, which put him years ahead of his fellow students in both terms of cognitive ability and emotional maturity, there were also areas in which he seemed completely oblivious. According to Kevin, Andrew had a tendency to be absent-minded, and while brilliant, not street smart in the least sense. He had lived a sheltered life, and things deemed important to others may not have even registered on his radar. In one particular instance, Kevin recounts how Andrew was gifted a mobile phone for his 12th birthday, though outside of playing some games on it, Andrew rarely used the phone, and when he later lost it, he was clear that while it may have served a purpose, he had no use for it and didn't wish to have the device replaced. In fact, when asked about a new phone, Andrew's typical response was to request an Xbox instead. Beyond behavior, Andrew was often mistaken for being younger than he actually was. 14 years old when he disappeared, Andrew still had a baby face accentuated by black wire-frame glasses and light brown, shoulder-length hair with the bangs swept down across his forehead, which, in conjunction with his stature, standing approximately 5 feet 3 inches tall or 1.60 meters, led many to believe that he was 12 years old or even younger. In the months leading up to his disappearance, Andrew seemed to have withdrawn from social situations he'd previously attended. Despite the devout Christian faith of his parents, Andrew had stopped attending church a year and a half earlier, though he did still attend school at Macaulay Catholic High School. In regard to stopping church, Kevin would later explain that Andrew's sister had stopped going and, quote, "I think he was partly following Charlotte in stopping church," end quote. According to Kevin and Glennis, they left it up to the kids to decide whether or not they wanted to engage with religion, and it was not something they'd force upon them. Andrew had also belonged to the Cub Scouts, though just a few months before his disappearance, he expressed his disinterest in attending those meetings also. Kevin would go on to explain, quote, "With Scouts, he just said he was bored. He seemed to be going through a quiet phase, which we assumed would alter in due course," end quote. According to Kevin, Andrew was a deep thinker and didn't typically make decisions spur of the moment. He rarely made decisions without giving them due consideration. So when he made a choice, as Kevin explains, quote, "He was the sort of person who would listen a great deal but not say much. When he did say something, it was generally worth listening to. He'd obviously thought about it a great deal from several different angles before reaching his conclusion," end quote. One activity Andrew did enjoy took place just a few months before he vanished, during the summer of 2007. He would go on to attend the Excellence Hub, a program developed and organized by the universities of Leeds, Sheffield, and York, which, according to their website, runs exciting events for young people to help enrich their experiences in school and college. Elsewhere, I've seen it described as basically a summer school program for gifted students. According to Kevin, while Andrew rarely spoke about school or opened up much regarding his activities there, the Excellence Hub was an exception, and he was reportedly enthusiastic and excited about the events and activities he'd been participating in that summer. It was also during the summer of 2007 that Kevin and Glennis made Andrew an offer. Maybe he'd want to enjoy his summer more with a change of scenery. According to Kevin, they suggested the teenager might have a fun trip out of town, and they asked if he'd like to go to London to spend time living with his grandmother. Reportedly, Andrew wasn't interested in the option and chose to stick around the family home for the rest of the summer. His days were divided fairly evenly between reading, playing on his Xbox or portable PlayStation, also known as a PSP, or sleeping. The dream summer life of a teenager, and perhaps one from which he was, at the time, unwilling to part, though sometime between his summer vacation and the early part of his next school year, Andrew would elect to change everything with an unannounced, unapproved trip to London. For a teen who rarely left the house, this was a big trip to undertake alone. Typically, when Andrew did leave home, he would leave a note behind or tell someone. However, on September 14th, nothing about his day would be typical. Thursday, September 13th, 2007, was a normal day for the Gosden family. Andrew was up in the morning, dressed in his uniform, and getting ready to catch the bus to school. Andrew was punctual and was almost always awake and getting ready to go on his own without the need of his parents or sister to have to get him out of bed. Most mornings, Andrew was out the door between 8 and 8:10 a.m., leaving behind his parents who would finish their morning preparations before heading off to work. After a day at school, chatting with friends and attending classes, Andrew would arrive home in the mid-afternoon. According to Kevin, in the week leading up to his disappearance, though, Andrew had been walking home from school rather than taking the bus, which was an interesting change in his routine. Upon entering the house, Andrew would strip off his blazer, leave it hanging off the back of a chair, while the rest of his uniform would go into the wash. Once the uniform was off, Andrew would typically be found clad in jeans and a t-shirt showing off the name and logo of one of his favorite bands. He'd head into his room to play games, read, listen to music, or whatever happened to capture his attention that day. Shortly after his parents arrived home, dinner would be made and the family would gather around the table and eat while discussing their day or whatever random topic families bring up at the dinner table. Following dinner, they would do the dishes together and put them away, and then it was either family time or everyone doing their own thing. On this particular night, Kevin recalls that he climbed down onto the floor where he and Andrew worked on a puzzle together. After the puzzle, Andrew sat down and watched television with his mother. There was nothing remarkable about the night. It was business as usual. Andrew didn't behave differently or say anything that seemed out of character or that might suggest any issues or concerns. Charlotte, with whom Andrew was very close, was never approached by her brother about any plans, issues, and especially nothing about any intention to go anywhere out of the normal routine. Sadly, though, this would be the last time that all four members of the Gosden family would share an evening together. The morning of Friday, September 14th, began differently than normal. The first noted issue, which the family has said was completely out of character, began when Andrew wasn't awake on time. Andrew had to be coaxed out of bed on that particular morning, and his attitude was described as irritable. Once up, Andrew is reported to have followed his normal routine of changing into his school uniform, prepping for the day, and then at approximately 8:05 a.m., he called out, "See you later," before exiting the home to catch the bus to school. Not long after Andrew left, the house was vacant as his parents and sister left to begin their days. The family had no reason to question Andrew's plans for the morning. He'd woken up late, but maintained perfect attendance at school, and other than the possibility of having stayed up too late and being exceptionally tired, there wasn't much thought given. Later that evening, when Charlotte, Kevin, and Glennis arrived home, they didn't notice anything to suggest that Andrew wasn't there. They went about their normal plans, preparing dinner, setting the table, and assumed the entire time that their 14-year-old son was down in the basement playing Xbox as per usual. When dinner was ready, Kevin and Glennis called out to their children to join them at the table. Charlotte appeared and took her seat, but Andrew never came, so she was asked to tell her brother that dinner was ready. Charlotte quickly discovered that Andrew wasn't in the house and told Kevin and Glennis. Upon entering Andrew's bedroom, they found what they would normally expect to find. His school blazer hung over the back of a chair, his tie draped over top. The rest of his uniform was located in the wash, and so the family assumed that maybe Andrew had come home from school and decided to hang out with a friend, which, while it was out of the ordinary, especially since Andrew was in the habit of leaving notes should he venture off during the day, wasn't it something outside the realm of possibility? Not all that worried, more a little perturbed, Andrew's parents picked up the phone and made a series of calls to their son's friends, thinking perhaps he'd simply lost track of time. It was during these calls that they realized something was wrong. Not only had none of Andrew's friends been spending time with him that day, none of them had even seen him. He hadn't come to school that morning, and when Kevin and Glennis called and spoke with administrators at Macaulay Catholic High School, they wondered why they hadn't received a call to notify them of Andrew's absence. Reportedly, this came down to a phone dialing error. When instructors had noted that Andrew didn't arrive for his classes, the office was notified and, as is protocol, a call was placed to the Gosden home to report Andrew's unannounced absence. Apparently, though, this call was misdialed, and rather than reaching the Gosden home, where they would have been able to leave a message on the machine, they instead called a number that just rang and rang and was never answered. Charlotte, when asked about the discovery, later told the BBC, quote, "It was just a complete panic. We initially thought something must have happened on the way to school. When we found out that he hadn't even been to school, even tried to go to school, that was even more terrifying." End quote. According to Charlotte, she and her father went out together while Glennis remained home, making calls and waiting by the phone in case Andrew tried to get through. Charlotte and Kevin took a ride along the route Andrew's bus would normally follow, looking for any signs or indications that could explain why Andrew hadn't made it to school. They didn't exactly know what they were looking for, but they believed they'd know it if they saw it. When they found nothing along the route to school, they began to visit nearby locations that Andrew may have gone, but again came up empty-handed. When the two finally accepted that they weren't going to find anything, the decision was made to contact authorities, who would obviously have more experience with this sort of thing. At approximately 7 p.m., the police were notified and arrived at the Gosden home to take notes and begin a search. When authorities were given the story, there was, initially, not a sense of urgency. A 14-year-old boy had cut school and hadn't arrived home for dinner. While we now know the incredibly worrying situation that would develop, at the time, this wasn't exactly a rare occurrence. Kids often skipped school and avoided returning home where they knew they'd have angry parents to deal with. But with Andrew, it was different. This wasn't his style, and if nothing else, the one place they would absolutely expect him to be is at home. Authorities took to searching the Gosden home and examined Andrew's room. Andrew had gathered some money in his room, cobbled together from birthdays and other celebrations. In total, approximately 100 pounds was located in his room, leading authorities to speculate that it wasn't likely he'd have run off and left that sum of money behind. However, it was what they didn't find that began to make them and the family wonder. Missing from Andrew's room were his keys, wallet, PSP, a pair of black jeans, a Slipknot t-shirt, a watch, and Andrew's bag. Left behind, however, was Andrew's passport, as well as the charger for his PSP. Beyond that, Kevin noted that Andrew did not appear to have taken a sweater or jacket should the weather take a turn. All of this, combined with the fact that Andrew's uniform was in the home, seemed to suggest that the teen had come home, changed clothes, grabbed his bag and a few items before heading out of the house. But why, and where had he gone? While family and friends conducted a search of the neighborhood and surrounding areas until it grew dark and difficult to see, police began their own search, which stayed fairly close to the Gosden home. A nearby park, Westfield Park, was also searched, but nothing was found. While canvassing the neighborhood, authorities began to pick up fragments of Andrew's mourning. Neighbor and family friend Reverend Alan Murray reported seeing Andrew the morning he disappeared. According to Murray, sometime between 8 and 8:30 a.m., he witnessed Andrew walking away from the Gosden home, but rather than heading towards his typical pickup location for the school bus, he says that he saw Andrew walking into nearby Westfield Park. At the time, Murray didn't think much of it and continued on with the course of his morning. This was the first confirmed detail which tipped off authorities and the family that Andrew's disappearance may in fact have been executed by choice. A security camera mounted on a neighbor's home showed footage of Andrew heading back to the family home shortly after the house had been vacated, indicating that Andrew had chosen to hide out in the park until he was sure his family had left, before returning home, at which point he changed clothes, packed, and was reported to have left the home for the final time at approximately 8:30 a.m., heading down Littlemore Lane back towards Westfield Park. I should note that the Gosden family has reported it was they who discovered this camera footage rather than investigators. For the family and investigators, outside of the camera and Reverend Murray's accounts, little information was gathered. Within hours of Andrew's disappearance, local media was notified and a leaflet bearing Andrew's image and last known whereabouts was circulated. The hope was that the faster Andrew's story could be spread, the more likely it was to find someone who either knew his location or had seen him throughout the day. This choice paid dividends within the first 3 days of the investigation when authorities were contacted by a woman who worked at Doncaster Station and recalled selling a ticket to Andrew. According to the woman, Andrew had arrived at the station and sought to purchase a one-way ticket to London. The ticket wasn't cheap, and when the clerk asked Andrew if he wanted to make it a round-trip ticket so that he could catch a ride home, which would only have cost an additional pound, Andrew turned down that offer and instead insisted on a one-way ticket. This, combined with the fact that the woman thought Andrew appeared far too young to be traveling on his own in the morning on a school day, made him stick out in her memory. Given this new lead, investigators went down to Doncaster Station and canvassed the area, assuming that many of the travelers riding the rails were daily commuters and may have seen or spoken with Andrew the previous Friday. After showing Andrew's photo and speaking with many passengers, police did locate a few people who believed they recalled seeing Andrew on the morning of the 14th. A few people reported seeing Andrew in the station and boarding the train. One woman recalled sitting near Andrew on the ride to London and stated that he was quiet, didn't speak with anyone, and was simply playing his PSP and keeping to himself. Now, given this information that Andrew had, it seemed, taken the train to London, authorities began to piece together the events of the morning. According to police, after exiting the family home at approximately 8:30 a.m., it's believed that Andrew's first stop was at an ATM, where he withdrew £200 from a £214 account. Being that ATMs only dish out funds in groups of 20, Andrew couldn't empty his entire account from the machine, but given the £100 he left behind in his room, it didn't seem that this was something he was overly concerned about. After pocketing the cash from his bank account, which police have since monitored and never noted any change to in the past 12 years, he proceeded on to Doncaster Station, where he purchased a one-way ticket to King's Cross Station in London. This particular train had arrived in London shortly after 11 a.m. The ride from Doncaster to London took just under 2 hours to make the 170-mile or 273-kilometer trip. The train was believed to have left the station at approximately 9:35 a.m. When the Gosdens were informed that Andrew had made his way into London, they were concerned and confused. They wondered where the teenager could have been going and what brought him to London. Andrew did have family in London, grandparents, an uncle. This at least opened the door that he may show up at one of their homes looking for help, or at least they might be able to recognize him amongst the crowds of the capital. When asked about Andrew's insistence on buying a one-way ticket, Kevin initially responded that he didn't consider it that huge of a deal, nor did he think it indicated that Andrew had planned not to return home. Being that he had relatives in the area, he considered the possibility that Andrew planned to get to one of their homes. Police in London were contacted, and searches were conducted, beginning in Chislehurst and Sidcup, an area in which Andrew had relatives living. It wasn't long before Andrew's family would hop on the train and make the same trip to London with the intention of handing out more leaflets and speaking with anyone who may have seen Andrew. Aside from spending time handing out flyers and speaking to travelers at King's Cross, the family also went to locations they thought might have drawn Andrew in, namely museums and events they thought he'd have visited. The return trip was difficult and hard on the Gosdens' hopes, but they were working hard to remain positive. They believed that Andrew was out there somewhere, though they couldn't quite wrap their heads around what had transpired that Friday morning. It was a question of whether Andrew had gone to London with the intention of disappearing, or if perhaps he'd gone there for some other reasons and run into trouble. Considering the state of the internet at the time, one initial theory considered the possibility that Andrew may have met someone online and either made arrangements to meet this person, or perhaps had been tricked into coming to London by a person pretending to be someone they were not. In order to try and determine whether or not Andrew had been chatting with someone online, forensic searches were conducted on the laptop in the Gosden home, as well as computers located at his school and a nearby library. None of these computers showed activity from Andrew that would indicate he was in contact with anyone. In fact, the family noted that as far as they were aware, Andrew didn't even have an email address. Multiple reports have noted that Sony was contacted and stated that Andrew did not have an online account on his PSP, and no social media pages were located to suggest that Andrew had been using them. If Andrew was talking to someone online, he had been doing so in a way which authorities were unable to track or determine. Reportedly, Microsoft was also contacted and confirmed that Andrew did not have an Xbox Live account required for online gaming. In addition to that, I do want to note that I've read many articles and speculation on forums suggesting that Andrew was some kind of a computer genius. But friends and family say he had little interaction with computers outside of school and was far from being a hacker or the type of person who could easily cover his trail. As time passed, the family struggled to come to terms with what may have happened to Andrew. Kevin took things extremely hard, wondering if there was more he could have done or something that he may have missed. By his own admission, he entered a very dark time following his son's disappearance, finding himself deep into depression, which was not assisted in any way by what he considers a poor investigation as conducted by the South Yorkshire Police. Investigators began focusing on Kevin himself, wondering if he may have played a role in the disappearance of his son. Kevin couldn't understand why, especially after the knowledge that Andrew had boarded the train alone, so why was he being looked at as a person of interest? The intense scrutiny of investigators, coupled with his worsening depression, and the belief that authorities were missing out on opportunities to gather information by dedicating so many resources to looking into him, led Kevin to attempt suicide, which thankfully he was not successful at. For the Gosden family, it seemed clear that important investigative steps had been missed due to their focus on Kevin. One of these steps had to do with additional cameras. There are more than 500,000 cameras located throughout London, making it the most surveilled city in all of the United Kingdom. Some statistics report that the average London citizen is captured on camera more than 300 times per day, which, just by comparison, an American citizen is likely to be captured on camera 75 times per day. So with so many cameras in place and such a high likelihood of being able to spot Andrew in and around London, why hadn't this been done yet? Well, that depends on who you ask. The Gosdens argue that the South Yorkshire Police wasted valuable time early on, chasing after a wild theory about Kevin, rather than doing all they could to try and track down Andrew. The South Yorkshire Police have, in return, claimed that within the first 48 hours of the investigation, they reached out to the British Transport Police and asked them to examine the security camera footage from King's Cross Station the date Andrew disappeared. According to the South Yorkshire Police, they were informed that no one had been able to spot Andrew on film, and it wasn't until 27 days after Andrew had vanished that an officer from the South Yorkshire Police was able to firsthand examine the footage from King's Cross, and it was at this time that Andrew was spotted, though nearly a month had already passed. Footage from King's Cross showed that Andrew had arrived in London via rail at 11:20 a.m. Andrew was picked up on security cameras multiple times inside the station, with one showing him walking amongst a crowd away from the train with his head cocked to the left. The last shots of the teen show him exiting the station at approximately 11:25 a.m. This is the last known footage of Andrew, and he is seen walking out of the station, passing by a man dressed in a white t-shirt. As Andrew approaches the doorway, his head turns to his left, then straight on, almost looking into the camera, with the final shot showing his head and body turned slightly towards his right. His Slipknot t-shirt is clearly visible in the image, and the strap of his shoulder bag is slung over his right shoulder and crosses his body down to his left hip, where it crosses back behind him. While discovery of the camera footage was highly valuable, the time it took to make this discovery, unfortunately, made it incredibly difficult to locate any other footage from around the city. A city such as London, with as many cameras as it has, does not keep footage for a long period of time. There's a schedule, from camera to camera, during which time footage is kept and then overwritten. The exact schedule isn't known publicly for security purposes, but by the time investigators found this particular footage of Andrew, much of the cameras in the surrounding area had already been wiped. According to Kevin, footage from security cameras located at a subway station nearby and buses that ran through the city was not even requested by authorities. Kevin went on to explain that Andrew had been to London with his family multiple times to visit relatives and friends, and was familiar enough with public transportation and the layout of the city to navigate it on his own. With flyers bearing Andrew's image covering the United Kingdom from corner to corner and the subsequent release of the surveillance footage to the media, sightings of Andrew were reported to authorities from locations all throughout London and beyond. One sighting, which the Gosden family believes may have some merit, was a report that Andrew was seen the day he disappeared at a Pizza Hut located on Oxford Street. This particular location is approximately 2 miles or 3.5 kilometers to the southeast of King's Cross, and according to Google Maps, would take approximately 47 minutes to walk, assuming Andrew did not ride public transportation that day. The majority of the trip would have been spent along Route A501. Another sighting was reported to have taken place the same day at Covent Garden in London's West End, located approximately 1.7 miles or 2.7 kilometers to the west and south of the Pizza Hut. Some believe this could have implied that Andrew was circling back around, as Covent Garden is only 1.6 miles or 2.5 kilometers south of King's Cross. Regardless of the possible validity of these sightings, reportedly, authorities did not follow up on them. Authorities in turn would argue that they had followed up, but were unable to verify if it was indeed Andrew who had been spotted that day. Kevin argued, however, that a woman who had spotted Andrew at Covent Garden was not spoken to by police for 6 weeks after she reported her sighting. Sadly, Andrew's case grew cold before investigators even knew where he had gone. When it was discovered he'd gone to London, the case warmed up, but the delay between London and then the surveillance footage being found made the case grow cold once again. Following that discovery and subsequent media coverage, multiple sightings were reported, though none could be confirmed. In fact, in the first year following Andrew's disappearance, more than 122 sightings were reported all over London and Britain itself. The vast majority of these sightings, some 45, were reported in London. Strangely, there were also 11 sightings reported in Brighton. Brighton is located on the south coast of England and is approximately 47 miles or 76 kilometers south of London. Again, though, none of these sightings have ever been confirmed or verified to have absolutely been Andrew. A year after Andrew disappeared, faculty and students from Macaulay Catholic High School took the train to London and distributed 15,000 flyers bearing Andrew's image. The first year was hard on the Gosdens as they went from a place of hope and possibility to the reality that they may never see Andrew again. While Kevin struggled to come to terms with the loss, he has since admitted that he succumbed to the overwhelming stress and emotional strain, falling into that deep depression, which he has stated dramatically impacted the family, and especially Charlotte. In an interview with The Mirror, Kevin explained, quote, "Because of my mental state after Andrew disappeared, I was unable to be the dad I wanted to be while Charlotte was still at home. We tried really hard to not change how we were with her, but I still have guilty feelings over that. I have told her this, and she hugged me and told me it was not my fault, as though I was some kind of an idiot to ever feel that way." End quote. 13 months after Andrew vanished, police in Leominster, a town in Herefordshire, West Midlands, received a bizarre message. On a Wednesday evening in November of 2008, a man approached this particular law enforcement station. Being that it was evening when the man arrived, rather than having a person on duty to receive anyone who might come by, an intercom system was in place instead. The unknown man used the intercom to report that he was in possession of information related to Andrew Gosden. The man was asked to stay put so that an officer could be sent to speak with him, but when an officer arrived outside, the man had disappeared into the night. Via the BBC, police and the Gosdens made a plea for the man to reach back out to them. They didn't care if he wished to remain anonymous. They just wanted to know what information he may have had. Reportedly, following the broadcast, the BBC received a letter alleged to have been written by the same man who went to the police station in Leinster. In the letter, the man reports to have sighted Andrew just 1 month prior in Shrewsbury, and while authorities report speaking to police in that jurisdiction, the sighting of Andrew could not be confirmed, nor could authorities confirm that the man who had written the letter was in fact the same man who had stopped at the Leinster station. Yet another possible lead that grew cold rapidly and could never be confirmed. The 12 years since Andrew vanished have been marked by sightings and rising hopes, as well as the case growing cold and the possibilities of a darker outcome. The following year, around the two-year anniversary of Andrew's disappearance, the Gosden family made public age-progressed photographs of what Andrew, now 16, may look like. The next month, in November of 2009, the Gosden family made an appeal to the gay community. In an interview with Pink News, Kevin outlined the family's consideration that Andrew may have been struggling with his sexuality, and this could have been the impetus for his choice to board the train to London. While acknowledging that the family had always been open, and that Andrew could have spoken to them were this the case, Kevin wanted to make it clear that they did not have any problem with his sexuality and simply wanted him to come home. Kevin would go on to say, quote, "If he is gay, we don't have any issue with it. He is loved unconditionally by both my wife and I and his sister, and the only thing that would await him if he returned or made contact would be a lot of missed hugs," end quote. One theory, which seemed to make the rounds in the years following Andrew's disappearance, was the possibility that he may have drowned in the River Thames, which runs 215 miles, or 346 kilometers, through southern England and does pass through London. In hopes of discovering whether or not this was a possibility, the Gosden family hired a private firm to utilize special sonar equipment used to locate drowning victims and items lost at sea. In a thorough search of the Thames, nothing was found to indicate that Andrew had fallen into the river, though searchers did locate a body, later determined not to have been Andrew. For the family, this was the first major public acknowledgement that Andrew may be deceased. In relation to the search of the river, Kevin said, quote, "None of us in our family can imagine that Andrew can be about for this long without making contact of any kind, because he was always quite a caring, thoughtful person. We just find it impossible to conceive that he would allow us to go through all of this for so long without even some kind of message to let us know he's okay. I guess we start thinking more about, could he have been suicidal and hidden it well, or could he have been abducted?" End quote. Several years later, in 2016, the Gosden family once more appeared on BBC television to make an appeal to Andrew, or anyone who may have information about his whereabouts. A year later marked a decade since Andrew had last been seen. That year, Missing People, a national organization in the UK previously known as the National Missing Persons Helpline, launched a campaign entitled Find Every Child. Andrew was selected to be the face of this campaign, which would have his image put on flyers, websites, and billboards which were erected around the UK. This brought the Gosden family back out, where they made more public pleas on television as well as written media and the internet. That same year, the authorities announced that they were looking to refresh the investigation. Police made a public plea for anyone with information to come forward. The appeal, posted on the South Yorkshire Police Department's Facebook page, summarized the case, noted that Andrew would have been 24 at the time, and stated, quote, "I would ask anyone, maybe new friends, neighbors, or workmates, who believe they know a 24-year-old man that could be Andrew, but aren't aware of his past beyond the last few years, to please come forward. In addition, any professionals, including doctors, dentists, or hospital staff, who may have treated a 24-year-old man who has no records going back beyond the last 10 years, you could hold information that proves vital to locating Andrew, and I would ask you to please make contact with police. And to Andrew, a personal appeal. Please contact us, completely confidentially, and let us know you are safe and well, and we can reassure your family you have come to no harm." End quote. The Yorkshire police have stated many times that they still consider the possibility that Andrew may be alive, though they do not ignore other options, and each year conduct a check on John Doe's on the chance that they may find Andrew, either alive in the hospital or perhaps worse. In 2017, Mick Neville, the former head of the Metropolitan Police's Central Images Unit, put forth a theory about not only why Andrew had gone to London that day, but perhaps what happened to him. Neville pointed out that on September 14th, the day Andrew vanished, the band Sixth was playing a concert not far from King's Cross. Beyond that, 30 Seconds to Mars were also in town performing a show. Neville suggested a connection between Sixth and Slipknot, one of Andrew's favorite bands, though the only link I could find was that Sixth performed as the opening act for Slipknot's 2016 UK tour. Neville argued that photos from the Sixth or 30 Seconds to Mars shows could show Andrew in the crowd if examined. Neville also suggested the possibility of a link between Andrew's disappearance and that of Alex Slossley, a 16-year-old who vanished in July of 2008, just 10 months after Andrew. Alex had lived in London and disappeared while visiting friends up north in Edmonton. Like Andrew, Alex was a brilliant math student who grew up with his family just 2 miles from King's Cross. No solid links have ever been made between the two disappearances, though Neville has argued they need to be compared, and he's even speculated the possibility that there could be a serial killer targeting teenage males in the area. In June of 2018, Kevin revealed that he had been contacted by someone who alleged a possible connection to Andrew. The person who contacted Kevin claimed to have had an online conversation with an individual who went by the username Andy Rue, a nickname his family had called Andrew from time to time, and that this individual explained that he had been abandoned by his partner and needed £200 to cover his rent. When asked for an account to send the money to, Andy Rue replied that he did not have a bank account as he had run away from home when he was 14 years old. The conversation apparently suggested that this Andy Rue could be living in the area of Lincolnshire, some 110 miles or 177 kilometers north of London. It was later reported that authorities did investigate this possibility, but the individual was never identified and it remains a mystery. According to Kevin, armed with this knowledge, he, along with friends and family, went to Lincolnshire, where they distributed more than 5,000 flyers and conducted searches. There were 4 possible sightings reported as a result of the flyers, but all were positively confirmed to have not been Andrew. On July 10th, 2018, on what would be Andrew's 25th birthday, new age-progressed photos were released to the public, police made comments to the media and urged citizens to come forward with information, and the band Muse, who Andrew liked, announced that they would do what they could to assist with the search. Muse had made a film during their Drones tour, and the film was to be played in more than 450 cinemas throughout the UK. A short clip produced by Missing People and directly addressing Andrew's story would be aired prior to the film itself in hopes of getting the story out to more people who may have knowledge they aren't even aware connect to the case. In just 9 days, it will be Andrew's 26th birthday. He's now been missing for 12 years, meaning that he's been gone for just 2 years less than the 14 that he spent with his family. His case has grabbed media coverage from all over the UK and around the world, as many have been baffled and confused by the circumstances of his disappearance. Theories abound in regard to what may have become of Andrew, or why he left in the first place, but for the most part, the speculation can be boiled down to 3 particular theories. The first theory suggests that Andrew ran away of his own volition. Considering the trip to London and his refusal to convert his ticket to round trip, many believe that, for whatever reason, Andrew elected to leave. Whether this trip was to meet someone or possibly take his own life is a matter which has been hotly debated. The second theory argues that Andrew may have been coaxed to London by an older individual or pedophile who may have been grooming the teenager. There are those who believe this may have happened via the internet through methods authorities didn't discover, while others, including Andrew's own father, think it's possible that someone in his life, a friend, a neighbor, may have groomed and manipulated him into going to London, at which point he was taken. The third and final theory puts forth the possibility that Andrew's trip to London was not meant to be the end of his journey. There are those who have argued that Andrew may have gone into London for reasons we've yet to discover, with the intention of returning home, only to have run into foul play along the way. For many, the most likely possibility is that Andrew was abducted by someone in London or outright murdered. Andrew Gosden was last seen on the morning of Friday, September 14th, 2007. At the time of his disappearance, Andrew was described as being a Caucasian male, standing approximately 5 feet 3 inches tall, with a slim build. At the time, Andrew had light brown hair nearly to his shoulders, and typically wore it with the bangs swept down across his forehead. Andrew's eyes are brown, and he requires a strong set of prescription eyeglasses or contacts. A key defining feature is Andrew's right ear, where he has a very unique double ridge. Andrew was last seen exiting King's Cross Station dressed in a black t-shirt with a logo from the band Slipknot, black jeans, a watch on his left wrist, black wire-framed glasses, and a black canvas one-strap bag bearing band names, logos, stickers, and patches. Andrew had in his possession his wallet, keys, and PSP, none of which have ever been located. Andrew withdrew £200 from his bank account, and there has been no activity on that account since 2007. Andrew was a brilliant student of math and lover of music, and was into the goth scene at the time. If alive today, Andrew would be 26 years old, and age-progressed images are available. Andrew's disappearance has been covered extensively throughout the UK and beyond. 12 years ago, for reasons unknown, the then 14-year-old hopped a train to London and vanished into the crowd. The Gosden family has struggled to come to terms with what may have become of Andrew, or why he may have gone to London in the first place. In his absence, the Gosden family has left Andrew's room as it was the day he went missing, minus a few posters and items which were taken by police to acquire fingerprints and DNA. The family has never changed the locks to their doors, knowing that Andrew took his keys with him. This past March, Kevin sat down and spoke with the Daily Mail regarding the struggle over the past 12 years. It was during this poignant interview that Kevin said that, in a way, he envied families who recovered missing loved ones' remains, for at least they knew what became of them. They had closure, even if it was heartbreaking. When asked about how he and his family have coped, Kevin responded, quote, "I kind of feel like I've lost everything, and every single day feels like a battle. You go back all the time thinking of every single possibility. What might be going on in a 14-year-old's head? We just don't know what made him disappear that day. You know, there just wasn't a single shred of his personality that would make us think he could do that and live with himself. So that perhaps makes us think, is he dead?" If you're a fan of Trace Evidence, you probably enjoy in-depth coverage of all things true crime. I'd like to tell you about a podcast that takes deep dives into some of the biggest and most well-known cases in the history of true crime, but also introduces listeners to some of the most bizarre, yet lesser-known cases out there. That podcast is Criminology. Criminology brings you in-depth analysis and discussion for the cases they cover using actual police files and reports. Hosts Mike Morford and Mike Ferguson include interviews with experts and investigators to make you feel like you yourself are part of the investigation. They also interview victims, survivors, and witnesses so that you get the scoop directly from the people involved with these cases. Criminology has tackled infamous and legendary cases, including the Zodiac and Golden State Killer, but they've also explored puzzling and shocking cases you probably haven't heard of, like the Pocatello babysitter murders, in which several babysitters were killed in Pocatello, Idaho, or the case of the Hatchet murders in Room 260, where a couple was killed inside a hotel that was hosting a mortician's convention. On Criminology, you'll hear about both solved and unsolved cases, which includes everything from missing persons to serial killers to cold cases to cases that are still in the headlines. So give Criminology a try today. They're bound to have an episode that interests you. Search for Criminology wherever you listen to podcasts, and be sure to subscribe today so you don't miss an episode. The disappearance of Andrew Gosden is a case that I've received a ton of requests for. There's so many questions circulating around this case that people can't help but be fascinated by the mystery and saddened by the lack of development. I've heard Andrew's case addressed before, and for a long time, I thought I'd heard all there was to hear. It wasn't until I started digging into the case that I found details I'd never heard, and information in particular about Andrew himself, that seemed to have been lost in the chaos. For the longest time, I found almost nothing about Andrew himself, outside of the fact that he was good at math and liked heavy metal. Part of my decision to take on this story was to try and present more of a background on Andrew, and maybe, from a place of further understanding, we might be able to approach new thoughts on his mysterious disappearance. There's a very active community that discusses Andrew's case. Many of them have gone to great lengths to gather information, as much information as they can, and yet it seems the more we learn, the less we truly know about this case. Andrew hid out in a park, waited for his parents to leave the house so that he could enter, change his clothes, grab a few items, and head off on a trip to London. No one's ever been able to determine what it was that made Andrew do this, or what it was in London he was looking for. Once Andrew stepped off that train in King's Cross, he walked out onto the streets of the city and seemingly vanished from the face of the earth. Someone out there must have information, or Andrew himself could still be somewhere, perhaps even hidden in plain sight. When you've got a case as confusing and confounding as this one, you've got a lot of interest, and that interest can often bring with it a lot of speculation and different theories. Most of the theories seem to exist in the orbit of three particular theories that encompass most of what is speculated to have possibly happened here. The first of these theories considers the possibility that Andrew's disappearance may have been something he planned and executed on purpose. When you examine the facts, the things that we know beyond a shadow of a doubt, it's somewhat difficult to dismiss this theory. I know that oftentimes in missing persons cases, we hear this possibility and there's evidence to throw it away, but here, I don't necessarily know that that's true. So what do we know? For reasons unknown, Andrew appears to have planned this trip. He knew to wait nearby until his parents left. He likely knew that by the time the school noticed he was absent, their call to his home would be met only by an answering machine, and that by the time his parents arrived home to hear that message, he'd have been in London for hours. Of course, due to an error made on the part of the school's administration, that call never came through, delaying his parents' knowledge of his absence a few hours longer. So Andrew heads home, changes clothes, leaves his school uniform exactly as he would have if he'd actually gone to school that day, grabs a few items, his PSP, his bag, wallet, and keys, and heads off towards Doncaster Station. Sometime after 9 a.m., he buys a ticket, and this is the first instance where we're faced with the possibility that Andrew may not have been planning to come home. Up until this moment, it's entirely possible that he's just a 14-year-old who's planning to skip school and spend a day in London. However, once the ticket agent offers him the option to make his ticket round trip for a cost that was fairly insignificant, and he chooses not to, that makes everything different. I do want to point out here that a lot of people point to the fact that Andrew left his PSP charger at home as some kind of an indication that he was planning to come back, and while that could be true, it's also entirely possible that he simply forgot it. Now, Andrew's father has argued that since there were family and friends in London, maybe Andrew was going to go to one of their homes and at that point get driven home or be given additional money for a train ride back. The problem is, he doesn't do any of those things, and if he was planning to come back anyway, why not spend the extra money to make the ticket round trip? This is really the first major detail of this case that people debate to their heart's content. I honestly don't have an answer here. I grew up in New York. I rode the Long Island Railroad more times than I can count. When you buy a ticket, it's typically not cheap if you're going a long way to, say, Manhattan, and the cost to convert that ticket to round trip is always worth it. Even if you don't plan to come back that day, that ticket can still be used for a certain amount of days afterwards. So why didn't Andrew do this? Honestly, you can debate that all day long, but the most logical thought connected to this is that he wasn't planning to come back. Now, you could say he's just a kid. What does he know? Maybe he just made a bad choice or wasn't really paying attention. But we know he'd been to London before, was familiar with the railroad, and was a math genius. So calculating the cost there wasn't exactly something he was incapable of doing. But sure, there's a possibility he wasn't paying attention or made a mistake, though the ticket agent's statement seems to contradict that, as she tried to talk him into it and he wasn't having it. So why does a 14-year-old cut school, hop a train to go hundreds of miles into a busy, crowded city on his own like he never does, especially when he's a total homebody? That's an answer no one has yet been able to determine, but running away certainly seems like a plausible option. We've heard all kinds of possibilities as to why Andrew may have gone into London that day. Some have been about meeting someone, others about a concert or an event. The truth is, this is an answer we're unlikely to discover unless Andrew himself is found and provides that answer. There are, of course, details that seem to conflict with the idea of running away. Andrew didn't bring much with him, the clothes on his back, a few items in his pocket, a PSP without its charger and a bag over his shoulder. He had at least 100 pounds in his bedroom that he left behind. He had 214 pounds in the bank, of which he was only able to withdraw 200. Though, had he planned ahead, he could have cleared his entire bank account by visiting a branch. It's difficult to analyze because on the one hand, we're trying to think like a 14-year-old, but on the other, this is not your average 14-year-old. You're not going to get far in London, or any city really, without some extra cash in your pocket. We don't know how much the train ticket from Doncaster to King's Cross was at the time, because railway tickets change prices frequently, and I don't know if you have it in the UK, but here in the US, prices vary based even on what time of day it is, whether you're on or off peak. I can tell you that according to a ticket purchasing website I went to today, if you were to buy a child's ticket from Doncaster to King's Cross, the rate varies between 18 and 50 pounds. That's for a train that leaves between 8:50 a.m. and 9:48 a.m. 12 years later. Suffice it to say, the cost was likely less back in 2007. Now, if you make this a round-trip ticket, you're looking at anywhere between an additional 10 to 25 pounds. It seems apparent if Andrew had 200 pounds on him that day, he'd likely have had at least 150 pounds left over once the ticket was purchased. Is it possible he needed a specific amount of money for something and that's why he didn't spend extra on making it round trip? Again, that's a mystery for which we have no answers. So we have two sightings of him the day he disappears, unconfirmed, of course. One at a Pizza Hut, another at Covent Garden. Both of these locations are within a few miles or kilometers of King's Cross. If Andrew's intention was to get to London to run away, he sure wasn't straying too far from the place that could get him home. Not to mention, he was spotted getting something to eat and then basically hanging out at a touristy attraction mall kind of area. If he was looking to run away, you think he'd want to get further away. But then again, maybe he got there and wasn't sure where he was supposed to go or what he was supposed to do, and he was hungry and he saw crowds of people and he just followed them. And maybe at some point, he did get further away, but at least in the early part of the day, he lingered around. We've never been told the exact time these sightings took place, but we know Andrew was on the streets of London by 11:30 a.m. So maybe we're never going to know why he went to London, or whether or not he was intentionally trying to run away, or if he was going to attend a concert, or buy something that he could only get there. Maybe the best option is to try and understand what would have made him leave in the first place if he was running away. Again, we're faced here with a lack of information. Friends and family say Andrew, despite being withdrawn, was generally happy, caring, and kind. He was close with his family, specifically his sister. So what could drive him off like that? No one reported him being bullied. No one believed he was struggling with depression. Now, at least in terms of depression, that certainly could have been missed. He's a teenager, he's moody, he wears black a lot and listens to some heavy music. It's not hard to hide depression when someone expects your general behavior to be dark. I was one of those kids and nobody knew I was suffering from depression for a long time. Not even me. Some people believe that Andrew may have gone to London, suffering from depression, with the intention of committing suicide. It's not a fun angle of the theory, but it's one that has to be looked at. When you're dealing with a suicide, there's no rational way to wrap your head around the thought process that someone could be following. It's not a logical choice, at least from most perspectives. So were suicide a possible motive for the trip, then things may not make a great deal of sense. But why go all the way to London if you're planning to take your own life? I know in some cases people will go far from home or to some place they feel happy or at peace to spend their final moments. But as has been the case with many a story that suicide is considered a possibility, typically concealing the location of your body is not part of the plan. You're looking for a way out, not necessarily what's going to happen in the aftermath. So had Andrew gone to London to take his own life, why wasn't anything ever found? Andrew's family have put forth the possibility that he may have been struggling with his sexuality and that he could have run off because he was confused, hurt, didn't think they'd understand, or felt ashamed about the way he felt. That's not a possibility that can be ignored either. And realistically, there are people going through this every day. It's a terrible thing to feel ashamed of who you are or to believe your loved ones might judge you or treat you differently. It's certainly something that should be considered as a possible motive for running away, especially if this kind of emotional and sexual confusion is coupled with depression, that can be a dangerous place to be. Andrew's family has said that they would have accepted whatever his sexuality was. Maybe he knew that, and maybe he didn't. His parents were devout Christians, and maybe he felt he was in conflict with those views. It's honestly hard to say. Ultimately, the problem with the runaway theory is that every person who knew Andrew, and specifically his family, have said they couldn't believe that he could run off and put them through the horror of wondering what has become of him for all these years without so much as a phone call. Not to mention the utter lack of confirmed sightings in a highly surveilled city where his face has been plastered all over the place. This leads many, including his own family, to consider the possibility that he's no longer alive or has been taken into a situation that leaves him unable to reach out and communicate. And that takes us to our second theory. There's been a long-running belief that Andrew may have been coaxed into going to London by either someone he knew and trusted or maybe someone he thought he knew. Andrew's father, police, and many independent researchers have considered the possibility that Andrew could have been groomed by a pedophile, whether it was someone local or someone on the internet. Now, investigation seems to suggest that nothing was found on any computer to link Andrew to any chat rooms, forums, or websites, but I can tell you from experience that as a 14-year-old boy, I was doing stuff on the internet that my parents, teachers, and friends had absolutely no idea about, and there were ways to cover it that weren't exactly challenging. And I was 14 in 1996. The internet was a lot newer, and law enforcement hadn't quite cornered the market on forensic examination of computers. I was talking to people older than me, I was having conversations with people who I believed I knew, but in reality could have been anyone. I remember having an extended friendship with a woman named Claire Anderson, who lived in Fridley, Minnesota. We haven't spoken in 20 years and I've never been able to find her. I can't help but wonder to some degree, did she even exist? So I do consider it possible that Andrew could have been talking to someone online and that that was missed by investigators. I mean, they did kind of miss a few things early on in this investigation that rattled my faith in their methods. So had that happened, with a withdrawn, not-so-social teenager, not exactly a challenge to earn some attention or confidence. Most people who avoid social interactions face-to-face find it much easier to do so online, so I don't think we can completely rule this out. I know there really isn't any evidence to suggest it, but as far as I've seen, there isn't exactly evidence to rule it completely out either. Unfortunately, every day, kids who are smart and kids who aren't that smart are lured in by professional con men and pedophiles who know how to play on their weaknesses, groom them, and get them to do what they want. This absolutely could have happened in this case. If Andrew went to London to meet somebody, by the time the door closed behind him and he realized something was wrong, it would have been too late. The other option presented by Andrew's father was that he could have been manipulated and groomed by someone local. Whether it was someone on the route to school, the parent of a friend, a teacher, a perfect stranger who happened to befriend him, we know that in the week leading up to his disappearance, he made one strange shift in that he no longer rode the bus home, but instead walked home. Kevin has often wondered if it's possible that this choice to walk home was done in order to spend time with someone they were unaware of. Remember, Kevin has admitted that Andrew didn't really reveal much about his days at school or his social life. And if this were someone who was skilled and experienced at manipulating a younger person, They certainly would have made it clear to Andrew that he couldn't tell anyone about their interactions. On the morning Andrew vanished, he woke up late. In fact, he had to be woken up and was irritable. His parents thought maybe he just stayed up too late, which is possible. But what if there was some method by which he was communicating with someone else, and that's why he had been up late? Andrew didn't have a cell phone. He'd lost the one his parents had given him years earlier and really wasn't interested in getting a replacement. But what if someone had given him a phone and asked him to keep it secret? That's wildly speculative, but a possibility. I've also often wondered if perhaps Andrew didn't get enough sleep the night before because he was nervous about his upcoming plan to sneak off to London. I suppose either option or a combination of the two could be possible. It's hard to say much more about this theory. It's absolutely possible that someone talked Andrew into getting on the train that day. Witnesses say Andrew kept to himself and played his PSP, which seems to indicate that he didn't meet anyone on the train that day, and there was no prearranged meetup to take place on the train. Surveillance footage from the station does seem to show Andrew kind of looking around, but we don't know if he was looking for a specific person, area, or if he was just a 14-year-old taken in the hustle and bustle of a busy train station on a Friday morning. One angle I haven't seen, but I'm sure probably exists out there somewhere, is the idea that Andrew maybe didn't buy a return ticket home because he was under the assumption that he was going to be meeting with someone in London who was going to get him home. Imagine he's talking to what he believes is a 14-year-old girl or boy, and he's got an interest or feelings for them. How hard is it to say, "Don't worry, Andrew, my dad will drive you home afterwards"? When a teenager wants something, no matter how smart they are, they're pretty good at ignoring things that normally wouldn't make a lot of sense. If it was someone local, it's hard to understand the concept of why Andrew would have to go to London to spend time with this person. Maybe they worked in London and told Andrew to come on in and they'd meet him for lunch. I don't know. Anything is possible when it comes down to this theory, which really doesn't help make it any less frustrating than it already is. Maybe it was someone he met online and he discussed the possibilities of running away, and this person offered him a place to stay. Some people believe that the whole process of hiding in the park, sneaking back home, and then hopping the train to London had to have been implanted in his head by someone else's suggestion. In all honesty, we simply don't know, and I can see arguments on all sides of this equation making sense. So if Andrew didn't run away on purpose and wasn't manipulated into the trip by someone with bad intentions, is it possible that Andrew went to London and met with foul play once he arrived? That takes us to the third and final theory. There's basically two angles to the final theory. Both of them are under the belief that Andrew chose to go to London that day, but that he may have had plans to go home. Again, we don't know the reason for the trip, but it's considered a possibility that that's all it was, a trip. Not something that was supposed to last for 12 years, and perhaps something that Andrew knew he'd be in trouble for, but considered worth the risk. If Andrew did plan to return home, despite the lack of a return ticket, there are any number of things that could have happened to him once he was in London. Some people go with the accident possibility. Andrew, at some point, stumbles or has an accident that costs him his life. Some believe he went into the River Thames, and while it was searched using sonar, it was searched long after Andrew disappeared, and based on the current alone, he could have ended up anywhere. Logic would say he'd ultimately turn up on the shore somewhere, but it's not a guarantee. People have gone into bodies of water before and never been found. It's a sad truth that has to be considered. Others think perhaps Andrew fell somewhere and was seriously injured. Or maybe he was struck by a car and the driver chose to dispose of him to avoid charges. Hard to say, again, but it's also possible. I don't necessarily put a lot of stock into the accident theory because in most cases it seems Andrew's remains, at a minimum, would have been recovered, but I can't say that beyond the shadow of a doubt. Others believe that perhaps Andrew met foul play at the hands of someone looking to take a life or harm an innocent. Mick Neville, for instance, has his theory. Going along with Neville's theory, is it possible that Andrew found himself the victim of a possible serial killer? Yeah, that can't be dismissed. I don't necessarily see the connection between Alex Slossley and Andrew, but it's unlikely that there wasn't someone in London at the time who, if given the opportunity, wouldn't have done something terrible to a helpless, possibly lost and confused 14-year-old boy who has at least 150 pounds in his pocket and a PSP which could quickly be fenced or sold off at a pawn shop. Not to mention, you see a 14-year-old walking around London by himself during school hours, and you've got the knowledge that he's probably not where he's supposed to be, and no one's going to miss him until they realize that he's not where he's supposed to be. You also have to keep in mind that while Andrew is 14, basically everyone in his life says he looks younger and is often mistaken as being a 12-year-old. So again, this may have made him look like a more easy target for someone up to no good. It doesn't have to be a serial killer. It could have been anyone. Maybe someone planned to rob the unaccompanied minor and things went badly. Maybe it was just someone who saw an easy target and wanted to do something terrible that day. Whatever happened, if indeed someone murdered Andrew, they certainly didn't just leave him lying around somewhere to be quickly located. Not a single shred of clothing nor any item that Andrew was known to have on him was ever recovered. We don't know that Andrew stayed in London either. He could have hopped a bus, taken a subway, and gone elsewhere, at which point you're looking for a needle in a haystack, except you don't know where the haystack is. There's a lot of space to cover, and in between those spaces, there's a lot of locations where a body could be disposed of that no one is ever going to think to look. The sad truth is that most major cities have elements that are dangerous, and areas that, while someone who lives there may know to avoid, a 14-year-old out on an adventure might not. Sure, Kevin claims that Andrew knew London enough to navigate it, but that doesn't mean he knew every area to avoid. In the year of 2007, London reported a homicide total of approximately 165 people. That's essentially a murder every 2.25 days. Not exactly an overwhelming statistic compared to some places, but enough that Andrew could have been killed. It's a possibility. And if someone's committing murder in London, they obviously have a way to dispose of the body without it being quickly found. That's not even to address the possibility of human trafficking. People are very quick to point out that Andrew didn't have his passport with him when he left, so they're saying that he couldn't have gotten out of the country. But how often does a human trafficker have to deal with showing a passport? They have ways around it. And if Andrew fell into the hands of the wrong person, it would not have been hard for them to move him elsewhere. So, could Andrew have gotten to London, planned to return home, and run into trouble? Absolutely. There's any number of ways he could have found himself in a bad situation. Whether it was a mugging gone wrong, walking into a bad area at the wrong time, speaking with someone who pretended to be helpful all the while was leading him into danger, or the possibility of some kind of an accident. The fact of the matter is, most people who investigate this case maintain the hope that Andrew is alive somewhere, but they don't stray too far from the possible reality that he is deceased. Even his own family, after all these years, is forced to confront that possibility. Andrew Gosden vanished on September 14, 2007, and 12 years later, we know very little beyond what was learned in the first weeks of the investigation. There have been sightings, but none have ever been confirmed. There have been rumors, speculation, theories, and suggestions, all of which lead to a giant question mark and only the reply that almost anything is possible. It's tragic, heartbreaking, and frustrating beyond belief. I can't begin to imagine what the Gosden family has gone through and will go through in the years to come. Maybe it's a hope beyond hope to think that Andrew is alive out there, and maybe someday might return. However, until the truth is revealed and Andrew's fate determined, everything seems to reset to square one. Someday, perhaps the answers will be found, and the Gosden family may find the closure that they seek. But until then, the case remains open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for more information about the vanishing of Andrew Gosden, there are many websites and forums available with information on his case. The website helpustofindandrew.weebly.com is a great resource for information about the case and updates. If you're on Twitter, you can follow @Andrew_Gosden for more information. If you have any information about the vanishing of Andrew Gosden, please call 0500-700-700, visit missingpeople.org.uk, or contact the South Yorkshire Police Department. What do you believe happened? tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, Instagram message me at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. A special shout out and thank you to Trace Evidence Patreon producers Alicia Lorraine, Krista Colvin, Deani Dyson, Eamon Brady, Emily Smith, Julia Rexon, Kate Alexander, Megan, Randy Weiland, Chandra Moreau, Tara Doble, Megan Cotter, and Tom Archer. Trace Evidence wouldn't be possible without the kindness of all of you amazing listeners. Visit patreon.com/traceevidence for more information. I want to thank you for listening to this episode and invite you to join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.